This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And what's there to say about yesterday's motion? Or maybe it was a non-motion on the Israel-Hamas war. It started as an NDP bid to unilaterally recognize Palestine as a state, which would have made us the only, or at least the first, G7 country to do that. Israel says that would be tantamount to rewarding Hamas for the October 7th massacre. Israel's defense minister and former IDF chief said as much to Justin Trudeau. Benny Gantz, maybe Trudeau's new Israel whisperer. And I think this is the second time they've talked in as many weeks. Anyway, the amended motion, which was presented and voted on at the very last minute, bore no resemblance to the original. It said Canada supports working towards a two-state solution through negotiations and getting to a just and lasting peace. All very nice sentiments. And it also said that Hamas must lay down arms. Now, everybody is declaring victory over this. Why? We will get to that in the panel. And closer to home, it would be almost impossible to avoid those progressive conservative attack ads on Bonnie Crombie, accusing her of being a big proponent of the carbon tax. Well, yesterday she came out and said definitively that she would not impose such a tax if elected. So will that put it to rest? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome former Ontario NDP MPP Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario Liberal Cabinet Minister George Smitherman, and former Ontario PC MPP and Finance Minister Janet Ecker. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Hello. Pleasure.
Okay, let's talk about what happened last night in Parliament with that motion, which was completely changed at the very last minute, and they voted on it at the last minute. They hadn't even translated into French. Janet, what do you make of it?
Well, the whole thing is just an exercise in absurd politics. I mean, the country, you know, it's not going to impact the country's foreign policy, whether you agree with how Minister Joly has been carrying this out when it comes to Israel. It's not going to impact it at all. It's just a whole bunch of positioning, badly managed. I mean, you know, putting something on the floor, you know, sort of at the last minute that is supposedly of this significance, just speaks to bad implementation, bad management, or total confusion. I don't know. But I mean, I think if you're really someone who's sitting in Palestine or Israel right now, it's just like, what the heck?
If they're even aware of it, it looked like the defense minister in the war cabinet, who is a centrist and the former head of the IDF, he may have convinced Trudeau that this was not a smart idea. I don't know. I mean, frankly, George, to me, this whole thing, and actually the same goes for just about every stakeholder in the whole wartime scenario, is about diaspora politics and doesn't really have a lot to do with what is going on over there.
Well, I suppose it's easy to say that what we do here is irrelevant to what's happening in Israel and in Palestine, etc. But at the same time, I think for tens of millions of Canadians, it is relevant. And while the sometimes the democracy is you know, characterized as a sausage making exercise that you don't really want to watch, I feel like the resolution where they landed is, you know, I think quite aligned with where many of our allies are, including the United States, with respect to a two-state solution, and many, if not most, European nations, etc. So I don't see it as a futile effort. I think that in the circumstances, which are very severe, it's important for Canadian Parliament to be on the record. And, you know, I think that the motion that was eventually supported is fairly good at reflecting where I imagine many of the points of view and sympathies are of Canadians.
It's no different from what the official policy is right now. Sherry, I mean, in terms of an NDP constituency, the NDP is trying to put this forward as a victory. I don't see how they can do that.
Well, I think it is in the sense that it represents over 70% of Canadians want either a permanent ceasefire, want to see either a permanent ceasefire or a temporary one. We've got a situation where 13,000 children have died, where 1.2 million people are in risk of starvation. The House was totally agreed that, you know, Hamas is a terrorist organization, but they're not the
legitimate before
government.
Those amendments. It wasn't.
I mean, they're not the legitimate government of Gaza, and everybody kind of gets that. I think the reality is that the children and the women and the others are victims. And I think, you know, the desire that Canadians expressed in that motion was, we need peace and we need it now. This is not helping the government of Israel on the world stage. Some 139 countries want to see Palestine as a state. That's our stated opinion, as a two-state solution. But we're no closer to that after decades of negotiation. So a degree of frustration, but mainly just a real hunger and longing on behalf of Canadians and the majority of parliamentarians for peace.
Well, I mean, again, what was voted on is what the policy has been for a long time. And Janet, I mean, I think that even the biggest proponents of a two-state solution, saying that in the current atmosphere it is, they keep saying, well, it's not going to happen right now because everything is just too raw. And previous agreements were torpedoed actually by the Palestinians, like the Oslo Accords. But in terms of Canada's influence, you know, a lot of conservatives say that Canada does not have any kind of stature anymore. Do you agree with that?
I think we've blown a lot of our global reputation over the last couple of years. You know, we used to be considered a strong middle power leader on some initiatives, et cetera. And we've just let our soft power and our military, frankly, our defense and NATO, et cetera, we've let that deteriorate. So, you know, are we still worth having around the table? I certainly hope so. But I can understand why a lot of our allies just shake their heads when they think of Canada. But the other thing about this as well is that, you know, it's fine to say, yeah, we need the two-state solution and all of that. But you're absolutely right. This is going to take a lot of parties at the table to make this happen. And it's going to take Hamas to surrender, to back off. I mean, we had a ceasefire. We had a ceasefire until October the 6th. And so it's going to take the Arabs, it's going to take a lot of players at the table to make it happen. I mean, and Sherry's right. I mean, everybody wants peace. Everybody wants this to stop. Everybody wants kids to stop being harmed and starved and all of that. But at the same time, it, you know, if it were that easy, it would have happened. So I'm quite not optimistic about it at all, quite frankly. But I hope that the players can get together with some of the Arab states as well. And the thing we have to keep remembering, too, is Israel is a democratic country. It's the only democratic country in that zone. And I think that says a lot about who we should be trying to help support.
Well, I mean, it's such a quagmire. The last set of negotiations broke down. Anthony Blinken said the ball was in Israel's court. They wanted to know, they wanted a list of hostages and with notes about who was still alive. And Hamas refused to give them that. I mean, that sounds pretty basic for me. The negotiations have apparently restarted, which is a good thing. And apparently Netanyahu has agreed not to go into Rafah right away. So it looks like the Americans may have gotten through to them. George?
I think Hamas just doesn't know. I think Hamas, they've lost control of the situation, and they don't know where some of those hostages are or if they're alive or dead, actually. I think that's probably got more to do with their refusal. Sorry, George.
Just before we get to that, my comment on that is they can't keep track of their hostages, which are huge bargaining chips, but the instant that there's any kind of anything happening there, they seem to have a complete handle on casualty counts with no infrastructure. So I think that bears thinking about as well. But George, do you see optimistic signs in those other things, a restart of negotiations and Netanyahu saying that he's not going to have that Rafah incursion right away?
I don't see any signs of optimism. I'm so sorry. I mean, I wish I could say that I did, and I wish I felt that yesterday's resolution in the House of Commons was a move towards me, making me a more optimistic individual. Perhaps if I see optimism in anything, it's that the United States, which is an obviously a supersized influence, is exerting its influence and seems to have some impact, even if it's to have delayed proposed events in Rafah or what have you. So, you know, I think that the resolution as it was written was problematic. The resolution as it was adopted is significantly aligned, as you said, with historic Canadian policy, and it doesn't put the cart before the horse in terms of granting to a people's or to a land nationhood that's not warranted in the current circumstances where the terrorist arm of the political party that governs them has been up to all that it has been up to. But it doesn't make me optimistic for where we're headed here or what path we're on, except that I think it is a good sign, as difficult as it must be, that Netanyahu and Biden are talking. Because if you want to talk about events that were extraordinary, I look to that speech from the Senate floor by Chuck Schumer last week.
Sherry, Janet mentioned what's happened to our military. So in Haiti now, we have 3,000 Canadians who are stuck. The Americans are getting some of their people out, but we are not. Canadians are not. And the Canadian military has been in Haiti for a very long time. And I know there were parties that wanted Canada to take the lead, but it looks like we are in no position to do that. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, and I want to talk about that, Libby, but I just back to the moments of hope. I do see hope and it's with Israelis. I mean, tens of thousands of them are in the streets. They are not happy with Netanyahu and what he's doing. There are 12 human rights Israeli groups that are calling for a ceasefire, too. So I see some hope there. But in terms of Haiti, yeah, I mean, we have we've been from the beginning, and this is not just our government now. This goes back quite a while. I mean, they elected Aristide. We were part of, you know, dismantling that government, quite frankly, in a shameful way. And we've been meddling in their affairs for a while now. Look what's come of it. You know, it's a terrible scene there right now. And you're right. We are not protecting our own there. So what's the lesson in this? I'm not sure that it's held by any political power, but, you know, think twice before you interfere in the governments and the actions of other countries. Certainly, I think to the point that, you know, has our international reputation been damaged here? I like to think that we are still seen as a force for peace and as a diplomatic force, but Haiti is certainly not helping that.
George, how do you view our inability, I guess, to act in Haiti?
Well, the thing is, it's one thing to criticize the lack of Canadian capability to zoom in there and expeditiously remove Canadians that are put at risk by these situations. But I think I spoke last week and said, you know, it's something I think is to recognize that Canada was under tremendous pressure from the United States, from President Biden over the course of, I think, 18 months to actually be in their leading efforts to try and create some kind of peace, if you will. And I dare say in the circumstances that would have been a foolhardy exercise for Canada to participate in. The decline of Haiti has been ongoing over a long period of time. And I think that there's probably a lot of fingers to point at messing around by external players in the affairs of that country. I would say overall, with respect to Canadian influence, a lot of the influence that people are talking about here costs a lot of money, whether that's foreign aid that some people don't favor. Some of those same people favor a tremendous amount more spending on military matters, etc. So I think it's important also when we're talking about what muscle we're going to flex or what have you globally, that people put their cards on the table in terms of how much additional funding they'd like to see go alongside that, as obviously countries are also grappling with all of the attendant domestic political pressures.
Of course, we're nowhere near the 2% commitment to NATO. Janet, again, how do you see the situation in Haiti and Canada's role or non-role in it?
Well, the question of whether we should or shouldn't be doing something in Haiti, we are not able to. I mean, that's the problem. We've got troops in Ukraine that if there's actually a firefight that lasts more than 3 days, they run out of bullets or something to that effect. And, they're going to have to rely on their allies to protect them kind of thing. So, unfortunately, the country just does not have the capability to go into Haiti. And I think, at this point, what does need to happen in Haiti is that some country or series of countries or UN or whatever to go in and try and at least restore order is the first thing, because you can't start rebuilding a society unless you have some sort of law and order or whatever, and that won't be easy to do. But unfortunately, I don't see how Canada could possibly go into Haiti with the lack of resources that we've got now.
And how do you think it's affected our reputation?
Well, I think it has affected our reputation. I mean, our biggest friend and ally, we can put friend in brackets, I guess, but our biggest ally, the United States, they've asked us to do something, and we've basically said, no, we can't. And Americans have a long memory, and so it's unfortunate. And I think Ottawa has to seriously consider what they're doing to the country, because someday somebody is going to really regret the decisions that were made regarding our military over the last several years.
Yeah, and the situation in Haiti, and talking about restoring order, I'm reminded of something that happened not that long ago with the Taliban taking power in Afghanistan. I mean, that's what it makes me think of.
Yeah, and it is really tragic what happened to Afghanistan. I mean, you look at the lives of women there now, it's just awful. And, they had hope when it wasn't that many American troops that were there. It was only something like about 2,500, which for U.S., I mean, they've got thousands in many, many other places around the world. It was really, really very sad. And I always feel very embarrassed as a member of a Western country that we let down so many people in Afghanistan. On the other hand, we can't police the world. The United States has tried that, and they've had a good run, if you can put it that way. But on the other hand, Canada has to pay attention to the fact that the world is full of people who run governments and run countries around this world who are not nice, and they don't play by Marcus of Queensberry rules. And right now, the only thing we've got in terms of defending ourselves, if we ever needed to, is the goodwill of the United States. And that's going to be very reliant on, their best interests, their own interests. And you can't fault them for that. So it's a serious situation for the country.
I'm going to give the numbers out again as we turn to a couple of more local issues. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And I want to talk about Bonnie Crombie, the fairly newly minted Ontario Liberal leader. I can't even imagine how much the media spend was on those attack ads saying, Bonnie Crombie, friend of Justin Trudeau, loves the carbon tax. And yesterday she and other people in her little group there, I won't even call it a caucus, said, absolutely not. We are not going to impose a carbon tax. George, will that put things to rest?
Well, I don't think it's going to fully put things to rest, but it's definitely going to be beneficial. And I think that what it helps to do, actually, to focus on this issue and all of the focus from Ford and from the financial resources of his very, very rich political party, has to actually create the construct that the Liberals want for the coming election, which is that she is the threat to Doug Ford. And I think she's very effectively, and I think Ford has contributed to this needlessly, actually, leapt over Merritt Stiles, whom I like and consider to be a woman of quite considerable talent, to be forgotten in the dust in the context of the upcoming provincial election. And my one thing for the beyond that, from a strategic standpoint for the Conservatives, rather than just having put this focus on Bonnie Crombie, is the real risk that they face, which is putting all of their attention on the carbon tax, absent of any potential, any focus, I should say, on core provincial responsibilities associated with public services like healthcare and education, which in various ways are in a very, very, very frayed circumstance. So I think is actually shaping up very positively for Bonnie Crombie, that the effort that they made yesterday is a very, very sensible reaction. And I went through the same thing with Dalton McGuinty, where there was an effort to frame him up before the 2003 election, and where he even did an event with the, you know, Canadian Taxpayers Federation, etc. So I think, good play on the part of the Liberals. I don't expect that issue to go away. But I do think there's risks for the Conservative in focusing everything they have on her and everything they have on this issue.
Sherry, what do you make of it? And there's so much misinformation out there everywhere that, I think probably people don't know what to believe.
I think it's a mistake on Bonnie Crombie's part. This is a Conservative issue. I think it's been overplayed. I would agree with George on that. It's based on, spurious kind of facts in terms of how much this tax actually affects people. But more to the point, I mean, if she's going to act like a Conservative, it's pretty blue red that she's working towards there, then people will just vote for Doug Ford. Why would she pick up on this issue and kind of fall into what I see as a kind of Conservative trap, which is, kind of taunting her, and she responds saying, yeah, well, I'm just like you on this. What's in it for? Why would I vote for a Liberal when I can get the same thing by voting for Ford? And I think that's shown in the polling, quite frankly. Now, this is not saying, much about Mart. Of course, I'm more of a fan of Mart. But I mean, again, wrong tact, wrong way. Yeah.
Janet, I mean, we've always known that Bonnie Crombie is bluish liberal. So what do you think of that move? And do you agree that Doug Ford and his party are making a mistake by focusing on her so much?
Well, if 6 months from now they're still focusing on the carbon tax, that's a valid question. But I think in the short term, I mean, one of the things, I like to joke, he who boils it down to a bumper sticker first wins. And, when you got a new leader, you want to try and define them before they can define themselves. So putting some investment into trying to do that is a good thing for the Conservatives to have done provincially. The carbon tax is not a popular tax right now, and so it's a good target to pick, because she did leave the gate open when she first got elected as leader. And I think politically, I mean, there's a good policy argument that Sherry's making about whether it was a smart thing for her to do from a policy wise, but politically, I think she had to get rid of the carbon tax. It's just one less target for Ford and his party to focus on. So what will be important is what she's going to come out with. And she rhymed off a whole bunch of stuff, some of which is already in existence, about what her policy was going to be. It sounded a little bit like a chicken in every pot kind of thing. But I think that'll be important for her. She's going to have to get out and define herself. If it's not carbon tax, then what is it? And while she's been trying to, I think, position the, or at least certainly wanted to position the provincial Liberal Party a little more to the center than where it had drifted with Premier Wynne, we'll see. But I think in the short term, they both did good things they had to do for their particular politics.
Okay, finally, I'm going to go around the table, but we got a surprise good news on inflation, Everybody says the big overriding issue everywhere is affordability. So inflation unexpectedly eased a little bit, and apparently food prices have gone down. I say apparently because that's not what I see when I go to the grocery store. George, is that going to make things better for the Liberal government, or is it kind of not enough yet?
Well, I've got a variable rate mortgage, so I'm cheering like hell for ongoing reductions in inflation rate, even if I can't see it at the grocery store exactly. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the federal election is not tomorrow. It's going to be in 2025. And if there are a few rate decreases, this certainly is going to be one point in of some benefit in the alleviation of the pocketbook expense that'll and challenges that a lot of Canadians are experiencing. So I'm pretty sure that Liberals, some of them, will be reading in even more positive news from that inflation count in the hopes that by the time the Bank of Canada comes around for its next meeting, they can see a quarter of a point reduction or something like that.
Sherry, is it going to help?
I don't think it's going to be enough to save Trudeau, but yes, it's going to help. It's going to help average Canadians, and especially, as George pointed out, with their mortgages and other debts. So, I mean, it's a significant, it's significantly good news. And I think, but I don't think it's good enough to save the Liberal brand.
Janet?
It's not going to save the Liberal brand, but hopefully it'll save a number of mortgage holders like George who have variable rates. One of the things you saw in the bank's financial statements that they all just issued in the last couple of weeks was how many defaults. So it's are starting as mortgages are coming up for renewal, credit card bills, et cetera. Consumers are hurting out there, and it's having an impact. So hopefully we've gone over the top of the hill on inflation, and Tiff Macklem can start easing up a bit. I mean, it's been good that he's hung tough. It's not easy. He gets a lot of flack, but that's his job, you know, to try and control inflation. And so hopefully this is a sign of light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, George Smitherman, Janet Ecker, and Sherry DeNovo. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye, everyone.
Right. We are taking a short break. And on the other side of it, you know, traffic, as if it wasn't bad enough, is about to get a lot worse because of, yes, more construction, this time on the Gardiner Expressway. I'm going to want to hear from you about what you make of that and what your driving situation is. 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Coming up is a chance for you to vent about traffic congestion. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740. And if you think that it's a problem now, it is about to get worse, possibly a lot worse. The city says the Gardiner Expressway will be reduced to two lanes in each direction between Dufferin and Strawn for 3 years, and that should begin as early as this month. And that, of course, is for the controversial rehabilitation of the Gardiner Expressway, which has been debated at City Hall for years. So again, the numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Jennifer Graham Harkness, Chief Engineer and Executive Director of Engineering and Construction for the City of Toronto. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So we have the Gardiner between Dufferin and Strawn reduced to two lanes, to one lane in each direction, and that starts this month. So what else is going to be closed in terms of lanes of traffic?
So we're beginning the construction activities. It'll begin this coming Monday, and we're going to be doing some intermittent lane closures. So what we'll be doing is reducing beginning with the eastbound lanes. We'll be reducing it by one lane so we can do what we call pre-construction work. And then once the work on the eastbound lanes is done, we will be moving over to the westbound lanes and doing some pre-construction work there. Those lanes will be open during the long weekend that's coming, and then the following weekend as well, including the Monday. And then around mid-April, we will reduce the Gardiner down to two lanes in each direction, and we'll begin the full-on construction of the replacement of the bridge, the bridge deck, the road surface that carries traffic, as well as work underneath.
And I gather, though, all of this construction is going to be paused for the World Cup, even though that's not imminent.
Yes. So the work's going to take 3 years to complete, but we we're well aware of the World Cup. So the plan is, and it's been included in the contract, that we'll pause construction during the period when the World Cup is on, open the Gardiner up to full traffic flow, and get people moving through through the city for the World Cup.
You're talking about 3 years. What are the chances that this actually takes 3 years and doesn't go longer?
So we've worked really hard in terms of looking at how the work will progress and the staging and the construction activities. Our contractor has been involved in terms of looking at the how to sequence the work. And so right now we have plans that it will take 3 years. We may encounter some challenges. It is complex, but we expect it's going to take 3 years. And we do have provisions in place that if we encounter delays, that we know we will. Our contractor is expected to get the work done on time, and there's provisions there if they don't.
In other words, financial penalties if they don't?
Correct.
Yeah, that's kind of a switch for the city. Have you done any work on how much this is going to slow things down for people who are driving along that road?
We do know it's going to have a significant impact on traffic. We've done a number of things in terms of looking at traffic modeling and seeing how we can make adjustments across the network of traffic signals and other work so that we can, what I would say, reduce the impacts and improve traffic flow in other areas while the Gardiner's under construction.
Right, but have you done any studies that say it's if you're going between point A and point B, it's going to take X amount of minutes longer?
So we did look at the traffic. We have done traffic modeling. In terms of exact minutes, I think it's difficult to say what the specific impact is going to be for traffic, because each person has got a different path, and there could be other things that impact it. What we do do with the traffic modeling is we look at if we were to adjust signal timing here and perhaps put traffic folks out there, will improve the traffic flow. So we use that traffic information for that.
Right, but there's no number that can sort of help people manage expectations.
I don't have a number off the top of my head, but I would say that, it will be busy. There will be congestion. And so my recommendation would be to, add extra time to plan your trip. And if possible, use other means of transportation. Transit is a great option.
Okay. I don't know how helpful that is without something specific, but I'm sure we'll find out soon enough how much extra time it takes. Jennifer Graham Harkness, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take another break, and we're going to talk about cars and driving again, this time about auto theft, violent auto theft, which has basically doubled in the last year. And in this first part of the year, there have been more cars stolen than all of last year. Again, some of them are violent. I'd like to hear from you. I know we have listeners who have had experience with their cars being stolen. The number's 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740, and we will be right back with more on that.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The numbers are increasing, and they are increasingly violent. Carjackings have more than doubled so far in 2024, while break and enters for the purpose of car theft have already exceeded the total for all of last year. Now, this is from an update delivered by Toronto's police chief yesterday. And of course, there was a national summit on carjacking just a few weeks back. And who can forget the incredible advice from a police constable who recommended that people just leave their car fobs by the door for the thieves rather than trying to do anything else about it. What do you think of that advice? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740. And again, I'm anxious to hear if anybody is about to leave the fob on their porch, easily accessible by the thieves, so it doesn't get stolen. And again, the number is 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-744-740. And now I'm joined by Elliot Silverstein, Director of Government Relations for CAA Insurance, criminal defense lawyer Ari Goldkind, and security expert and former Toronto police officer Ross McLean. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let us.
Great to be here, Libby.
Great. We haven't talked to Ross for a very long time. So, what do you make of the way this is being handled? We saw this advice, which the police characterized as well-meaning, that just leave your car key for the thieves.
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy, and you know what the officer said. I think he said it in the most foolish way he possibly could. What he was trying to say was, don't get in a physical confrontation to save your car. However, the way he said it and the intention behind it is something that makes people shudder when you're just supposed to give up when someone comes to rob you and steal for something from you. Because most people feel that if you're going to do that, you're basically encouraging more thefts to go on. And I don't think they're necessarily wrong when they think that way, Libby.
Ari?
So, Libby, I know this officer, and immediately after I saw that clip go viral, including in the United States, I talked to him and I said, Marco, you probably could have used different words to convey the fact that the Toronto Police Service has on a number of files now, and I don't mean frontline officers, Libby. I'm talking, you know, the Hamas, which we lie and call Palestinian protesters. They're all just sitting on their keisters as if they're handcuffed, as opposed to handcuffing the bad guys. This is a viral video that deservedly went viral. I think it raised a lot of Torontonians' eyebrows, including people that are far left of left, who are starting to stop drinking that Kool-Aid and understanding what's going on in the city. The only regret I have, and, you know, there's a story that came out 6 days ago, and I think it's very connected here, Libby, but you're not allowed to talk about it, which is that half of Canadians now believe, a half, that the immigration numbers are too high. No conversation about what's going on in this city. The rise of violence, the rise of the depravity of the violence, the machetes, the carjackings, the home invasions, the amount of guns running around the street. I get a little bit worried when we get distracted on a viral video of the Toronto police officer saying something relatively silly that he wasn't artfully saying the way a lawyer or advocate would, versus not talking about the much, much bigger picture and the much bigger issues that are driving a rise in crime, Libby, and I'll leave my answer here, that I can guarantee your listeners it is going to get far, far worse, and we're just scratching the surface of it.
Okay, but keeping to the issue of car theft, Elliot Silverstein, first of all, if somebody actually does leave the key out for a car thief, do they still get covered by their insurance?
So at the end of the day, what we want people to do is make sure their possessions are stored away properly. I mean, you know, a lot of people tend to put a key on a hook at the front of the house. That's been in tradition. You know, there's been conversations about trying to use Faraday pouches and so forth. I mean, you know, again, there are people that have their car stolen in crimes of opportunity when they run into a coffee shop and grab a cup of coffee. It's not a good decision. And you know, again, it's a lapse in judgment sometimes in those cases. What we really try to underscore is that we want people to be safe. We want people to take the right precautions, because a vehicle theft or even a carjacking, they have physical and emotional impacts. Again, you know, it's somebody getting into your home potentially, but at the same time, just having your car stolen is an emotional impact. It's a violation. And we really want to try and help people take the right steps and do what needs to be done that fits your lifestyle to keep your car and your family as safe as possible.
Right, but you didn't answer. If you leave your car fob out for a thief, are you still covered by your insurance? Yes,
you know, it's really tough to say, because, again, you know, if you're leaving it outside of the home where it's essentially picking it up in your mailbox, it's a different type of risk. I can't speak to what's in specific policies or others, but, you know, our answer has always been we want you to keep your possessions locked up as best as possible. And, you know, again, the majority keep it put in the house in a drawer on a hook, in your jacket and so forth. That's where it should be.
Okay. I think the answer is you may not be covered, people. Again, let me give the numbers out. I know there are people out there who've had their cars stolen. And given some of those violent circumstances, I'd like to know what you think of what is going on. And Ari is saying that it's going to get worse. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Ross McLean, we had this summit on car theft. We sort of know how it happens. There are different groups of criminals. One group steals the car and then it gets to other people and makes its way to a container and gets overseas. What's your take on the organization of it?
Yeah, great question. I was just wanted to talk about that, Libby. And Ari is not far off with what his description was there. The big thing we have in common here is the Canadian Border Services for doing things. Look, these car thefts are being driven by international crime rings that support terrorism, drug smuggling. Hezbollah has a lot of people over here doing it. And what happens now, Libby, there's an online network for car thieves. They actually go by, they'll look to see the VIN number on the dashboard of your car. They'll scan it, then they'll upload it to a website. They'll look to see what features are on those cars, and someone will say if they'll buy that one, if they'll steal it or not, over in Africa, and what they'll pay for it. Then they get the list of the cars, they go out, and they steal them. The car stealers get paid off, somehow probably online. They deliver it to someone else who then drives it to the docks. They get paid online by somebody else. The guy at the dock loads it up onto a container. He gets his little piece of it. Off it goes to the other country. The person who receives that car gets a little piece of it. And then a $100,000 car here gets sold for $300,000 in Africa. You can actually look it up for doing that. So there absolutely is a complete criminal network for this. And Ari will know some of this. You'll get kids 14, 15, 16-year-olds doing this because they can make $1,000, $1,500 at a time for doing this. And I talk to the coppers that I know of. Cars are being stolen every night. Probably 40, 50 across the GTA are being stolen every night. A ton of it goes through Quebec. The coppers I know will stop any Quebec license plate that they see at nighttime driving around because they come in from Quebec, they steal them, they drive them right back to Quebec and onto the containers. So the Canadian Border Services, which handles their immigration, which looks after screening those containers, doing all of that, they're the ones that are really at the base of allowing this network to continue.
Okay. So a couple of things. The stat I saw was that this amounts to one car being stolen every 40 minutes. And the other question is, one of the things that was suggested was, like, do a security check on anybody working at a port. Would that help?
Well, that's part of it. But I said it is a network. Like, this is all being conducted online. The whole marketplace for doing all this is all conducted online. The payments will be online. We've dealt with this corporately. I dealt with this in different areas. It used to be with technology distribution. They do the same thing to steal high-end laptops, the same kind of idea. They find dupes, some kid who's online, he says, hey, I can make $1,500, or they'll pay me, or they'll give me this. All I got to do is do this, and we'll do it five times a week. We'll make coin on this. So, I mean, that's where the real demand for this is, the fact that people can get paid for this. I mean, talk about a side hustle. You're a carjacker. That's your side hustle.
Elliot Silverstein, the numbers that I've seen on insurance are staggering, that it has cost insurance companies something like $1.2 billion and added about $130 to the average bill. And that's not the bill of the people whose cars are considered most desirable.
That's true. I mean, the impact on the industry has been significant, and we're not seeing any changes. And that's part of the problem, is that we want to see the financial impacts go down. And that's why we have really been saying that everybody has to do their part, because the average consumer should not be having to shoulder the costs for a lot of these incidents. We need to see, and we're already seeing law enforcement at the table doing some pieces. We're seeing the conversations happening. What we need to see is tighter vehicle standards from the federal government. We need to see auto manufacturers putting in the necessary technologies to keep these cars safe. You know, again, for the average consumer, you know, they're trying to do their best to keep their car locked up, things put away, and listening to the tips that are being provided. But that can only go so far. And what we don't want to see is that consumers end up paying for it in the pocketbook even further because there's been inaction in other areas.
Let's take a call from Frank in Concord. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Libby. How you doing?
I'm fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
You know, I can't believe what the hell's going on. Who do we have at the Port Authority? We got Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles. They don't see anything. And they don't see all this deception and things going on. And we have the government and the auto manufacturers. You can't figure out how to not have your car stolen. I'm a mechanic, you know, 50 years. Come on. Yeah, they've been stealing cars for... Why can't you conceive a system where you can not have a car stolen? Come on. They used to have hot wiring in the old days. You connect two wires together and get the car on the road. Now it's all computerized. You got to be a computer... surgeon, almost like Steve Jobs over there. And come on, you can't figure out how to not have a car stolen. And
good
you have
point.
Key fobs stolen. Like, what does it matter? Do you have your key fob in the front or the back? Come on, figure it out. These guys, they're very smart.
Okay. Figure it out. There are a lot of people, Ari, who say that it's really the onus is on the manufacturers to make the cars harder to steal.
All right, so let's get into this. I know we have very little time left. Let me get my last word in here. Any conversation about what law-abiding people, let me speak directly to your audience, but any conversation about what law-abiding people should do, whether it's their keys, how they park, whether they buy the club, what car manufacturers do, is utterly ludicrous to me. It's ludicrous. We either live in a safe society where we put carjackers, home invaders away, we change the YCJA, the Youth Criminal Justice Act, which has become a joke, which your guest alluded to, which is 14 and 15-year-olds do this because they know even if they get pinched, the court will apologize to them and say, rap on the hand the way it was like a young fight 30 years ago where two kids shouldn't really have a criminal record. This is a level of violence that nobody wants to talk about. Two, you cannot talk about this without talking about our border, who we're letting in, the amount of cultural differences that are taking place here. Who do we think are stealing all these cars, the Amish and the Mennonite? So when I sit here and I hear people have to hide their keys or the Faraday bags, we either live in a Canada that values law and order and that law-abiding people can drive around and go to bed at night without waking up in the morning and going, I wonder if my car is in the driveway. To me, it's insane. And for any of your listeners who go, well, this really doesn't affect me. I live outside of the madness. The madness is coming to you. And when you get your insurance renewal bill, as Mr. Silverstein just told you about, that $75 or $125, that's because of this garbage. It's not on law-abiding people to fix, Libby, and any conversation that suggests it irks me.
Ross, but in the meantime, doesn't it make sense for the manufacturers to tighten things up and for people to take measures?
It seems reasonable, but the truth is, if you add the $50 cost to every car made by Toyota, every car made by General Motors, every car made by Hyundai, it goes into the billions of dollars for doing it. I'm on side with where Ari is going here. Look, same with your house door, the house door that they're kicking in to take your key fob. Now, you could turn your house into a fortress to protect yourself, or perhaps the police and the courts and the federal government and the border security can deal with it so you don't have to build your front door like a vault, which is, you can do it, but it's going to cost you a fortune and it may not necessarily save you all the trouble. So I think the authorities really do have to do their part now. It's pretty clear they're running with their tail between their legs, not able to keep up.
Elliot Silverstein, I'm going to give the last word to you. What are you telling your clients to do?
We're telling everybody to protect themselves as best as possible. Consider things like immobilizers, you know, look at Faraday pouches, whatever works for their lifestyle. But at the same time, we are really trying to push for standards to change. You know, the last time that vehicle standards changed in Canada was 2007. We had iPods at the time. We didn't have iPhones. The technology being used to get to these vehicles are, you know, far exceed what the standards say. So if we can start making those changes, and that's what we're working on, we're going to create a safer environment because the cars will be harder to steal, and we're going to try and end these issues. But consumers need to protect themselves today for the issues that they're facing today.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Elliot Silverstein, Ross McLean, and Ari Goldkind. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.